Welcome back to the Deep Dive, everybody. Today we're going to be tackling a really big idea in the Old Testament, and that is God as Redeemer.
Okay.
You sent me this fascinating lecture, a theological lecture by Dr. Tiberius Rada on this idea of God as Redeemer in the Old Testament.
Right.
And so I thought, let's do a deep dive on that
Right.
and really. Try and extract some of the key insights
Yeah.
into what it meant for God to be seen as Redeemer through some really pivotal Old Testament stories.
Yeah, that's a great topic.
Yeah.
And I think what we see consistently in the Old Testament is God portrayed as this active rescuer and deliverer
Right.
of his people.
Yeah.
And so we can definitely draw on Dr. Rada's analysis.
Yeah.
It's particularly his focus on
Yeah.
those moments of
Yeah.
redemption.
Yeah, and I think if we're talking about defining moments of redemption, like the Exodus has to be
Absolutely.
ground zero, right?
Yeah.
For understanding this,
This work of God in the Old Testament.
Yeah, I mean it really does set the stage
Yeah.
for understanding God as Redeemer throughout the entire Old Testament. I mean
Yeah.
the landmark event that everything builds on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's sort of dig deeper into how this idea of redemption is actually expressed, like how it shows up in the text.
Right, yeah.
And Dr. Rada points out some crucial Hebrew and Greek words.
Right.
What can these terms tell us?
Right. Well, I think what's fascinating is that the original languages give us different facets of what it means
Sure.
to redeem, right?
Okay.
And so in Hebrew we have the word gal.
Okay.
And this word isn't just about setting someone free, it's it carrying this weight of kinship.
Okay.
So, think about the Book of Ruth,
Right.
where the gal, which is the kinsman redeemer,
Right.
steps in. So it's not just some distant, transaction.
It's a family member
Right.
with a responsibility
Right.
back,
Yeah.
right?
So it's not like some detached deity
Yeah, is
coming
that?
in and, just sort of like righting a wrong. It's
Yeah.
really, it implies that God is involved in the lives of his people,
Yeah.
like intimately.
Yeah, it's a deep familial connection
Yeah.
and responsibility,
Right.
right? Then you have Pada, which focuses more on the act of buying back or paying a ransom.
Okay.
And then we move to the New Testament Greek. We
Yeah.
have lutromai, which generally means to set free or redeem.
Okay.
And then you also have agorazo, which literally means to
Yeah.
choose to buy in the marketplace,
Okay.
the agora.
Right.
Yeah, so it's like a deliberate act.
Okay. Yeah, that's much more deliberate.
And so Dr. Rada highlights that the significance of these words isn't fixed.
Yeah.
Right. Their meaning kind of evolves as we move from, say, the legal texts of the Old Testament to the later historical and
Right.
prophetic books. Right.
Okay.
So, for instance, while Peda initially focuses on a literal ransom in
Right.
later prophetic books,
Okay.
it can also take on a more metaphorical sense
Okay.
of God delivering his people
Right.
from spiritual enemies,
Right.
not just physical ones.
Right. Okay, yeah. So the very language itself
Right.
gives us this kind of
Okay.
evolving
Yeah.
understanding of what God is doing in terms of redeeming.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's plunge into the Exodus. Dr. Rada frames the Exodus through the lens of conflict, which is a really compelling
Yeah.
way to look at it. So unpack that for us.
Yeah. So if we analyze the Exodus as a conflict, we see several layers there, right? So you have the
Yeah.
direct confrontation between Yahweh and Pharaoh.
Right.
But what Dr. Rada emphasizes is the deeper conflict of
Yeah.
Yahweh versus the gods of Egypt.
Right.
And this really comes to the forefront in
Yeah.
chapter 7 through 9
Right.
with the plagues.
Right. Yeah, those plague stories always felt to me like they were
Yeah.
more than just punishments aimed at Pharaoh.
Right.
It felt like a battle
Yeah.
for supremacy
Right,
on
exactly.
this cosmic scale.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right.
It wasn't just about freeing
All
slaves. It
right.
was about demonstrating
Right.
whose power was real.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, some scholars even suggest a third conflict,
Okay.
Yahweh versus Israel themselves.
Okay.
Right.
Right.
Highlighting their doubts and disobedience
Okay.
even as they were being liberated.
Okay.
But the the core conflict is undoubtedly Yahweh's showdown with the Egyptian pantheon, right?
Right.
Exodus 12:12 is a key verse that underscores this.
Remind us of that core message of that verse.
Yeah, it states that God would pass through Egypt, strike down the firstborn, and on all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgments.
Right.
And so, you know, this clearly articulates a primary purpose of the plagues to demonstrate Yahweh's absolute power to judge the false deities of Egypt.
Right.
And so, you know, through these acts of judgment, God wasn't just freeing the Israelites physically.
Right.
He was actively revealing himself as the one true Redeemer, distinct from and superior to these false gods they had been surrounded by.
Right, right. So each plague wasn't just this random act of devastation. It had this very specific theological purpose in sort of like dismantling the perceived power of these Egyptian gods.
Exactly. And while the first nine plagues were powerful displays of God's might, Dr. Rada points out that the 10th plague, the establishment of Passover, carries profound significance.
Right.
It's not just the final act of judgment that compels Pharaoh to release the Israelites.
Right.
It also foreshadows Christ as the ultimate Passover lamb.
Right.
Whose sacrifice brings about our ultimate redemption.
Okay, so we see this clear thread connecting this, you know, pivotal Old Testament act of redemption to the New Testament understanding of salvation.
Right.
But before we go down that road, let's sort of step back.
Okay.
You know, beyond this dramatic Exodus event, what did redemption look like in the daily lives of people in the Old Testament, like practically speaking?
Yeah, I think in the early Old Testament, redemption was very much tied to the material realities of life, specifically land and people.
Okay.
And so the Israelites understood themselves as tenants on God's land.
Right.
And Leviticus 25 lays out these provisions for the redemption of property.
Yeah.
So if a person fell into poverty and had to sell their land, their closest relative, again, the goal, had the right and responsibility to buy it back.
Okay.
And so it was a way of keeping families connected to their ancestral inheritance, ensuring long-term stability.
Yeah, it was like a built-in mechanism to prevent permanent economic ruin for families, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like a way to like maintain your place within the community.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And if there was no kinsman able to redeem the land, the original owner could redeem it themselves if their circumstances improved.
Okay.
Dr. Rada also highlights the importance of the year of Jubilee, where land would automatically revert to the original family.
Okay.
And so it provided this kind of economic reset every 50 years.
Right.
And it was a system designed to prevent the permanent accumulation of wealth and the marginalization of families.
Right.
You know, and it's a concept that resonates even today when we think about economic inequality.
Yeah, that's a surprisingly progressive system for its time.
It is. It reflects a deep concern for social justice and the well-being of the community.
Right, right.
Right.
Yeah. Really interesting.
Yeah. And this concept of redemption also extended to people.
Okay.
So if a fellow Israelite became so impoverished that they had to sell themselves into servitude, their kinsmen could redeem them. And it's important to understand, as Dr. Rada emphasizes, that this wasn't the same as the chattel slavery we think of later in history.
Yeah. Right. Right.
The context here was providing a safety net for the poor within the community.
Right.
Right. And so there were limits
to
this servitude.
Right.
And it was intended to be a temporary measure of support.
Right.
Dr. Rada makes an interesting point, too.
Yeah.
That houses in walled cities were treated differently than land and houses in rural agrarian areas.
Okay. Okay.
Right. underscoring that fundamental importance
right.
of land ownership in their society.
Okay, so redemption in its initial Old Testament context was deeply practical and community-oriented, focused on preserving families and ensuring a measure of economic fairness.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so now let's circle back to the Exodus and those plagues.
Okay.
And Dr. Rada really emphasizes the I am Yahweh theme.
Yeah.
What's the significance of that repeated declaration?
Yeah, so the repeated phrase I am Yahweh throughout the Exodus narrative is God's way of revealing his unique identity and power to his people.
Right.
You know, after generations of slavery in Egypt, surrounded by a multitude of God's, you know, potentially influenced by Egyptian religious practices, God was forcefully asserting his singular and true nature.
Right.
As Dr. Rada mentions, it's in Exodus 3 that God first reveals his name as I am who I am.
Right.
And so... the plagues weren't just about freeing the Israelites.
Yeah.
They were a direct challenge to the entire Egyptian religious system.
Right.
A powerful declaration of who the one true God is.
Right. So the plagues were like this direct confrontation.
Not exactly.
Demonstrating the utter powerlessness of these so-called gods in the face of Yahweh.
Exactly, yeah. And Dr. Rada describes the plagues as a direct assault on the gods and goddesses of Egypt, exposing the futility of these human-made idols, fashioned from stone and wood, incapable of seeing or hearing or acting, in contrast to the living and active power of Yahweh.
Okay, let's sort of walk through some of the key plagues and the Egyptian deities that they specifically targeted.
Yeah.
So the first one, the Nile turning to blood, that was a direct strike against an Amun, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So Amun was revered as the protector of the Nile, the very lifeblood of Egypt.
Right.
And his role was to ensure its fertile flow. And so when the Nile, the source of all sustenance, was turned to blood and became undrinkable, it directly undermined Amun's supposed power and ability to provide and protect. Dr. Rada also mentions that while there are naturalistic explanations offered by some scholars involving heavy rainfall, red soil runoff, algae blooms, the theological interpretation sees this as a deliberate act demonstrating Yahweh's dominion over what the Egyptians held sacred.
Right. It's really interesting how a single event can have both natural and theological interpretation. What about the second plague? The infestation of frogs.
Right.
Which deity was associated with that?
So that targeted Hecate, the frog-headed goddess of childbirth and fertility.
Okay.
And so, you know, because the frog was her sacred animal.
Right.
Egyptians held them in high regard and wouldn't kill them.
Right.
And so, you know, imagine the utter chaos and revulsion as the land became overrun with frogs.
Right.
Which then died and created this putrid stench.
Yeah.
And so the Egyptians were forced to despise the very creature that they worshipped.
Right.
Dr. Rada notes that Egyptian magicians were able to replicate this plague, suggesting some limited power at play.
Okay, so maybe some of these events had natural parallels that the magicians could tap into.
Right.
Then we have the plague of gnats.
Right.
Or mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Which targeted Seb, the god of the earth.
Yeah.
What makes this one stand out?
So, you know, this plague against Seb, the deity associated with the very ground from which these insects arose, was particularly humiliating.
Right.
More significantly, the Egyptian magicians could not duplicate this plague.
Okay.
And Dr. Rada quotes Philip Ryken's theological interpretation here, suggesting that this highlights a fundamental limit to demonic power, right?
Right.
While such forces might be able to mimic or manipulate, they cannot create life.
Okay.
Liberal scholars, on the other hand, often point to natural explanations,
right,
like increased breeding in the receding floodwaters of the Nile.
Right. It's fascinating how these events continue to be debated and interpreted through different lenses.
Right.
The fourth plague was the swarms of flies directed at Khafre, the god of flies.
Yeah.
Any key takeaways?
Yeah. So, again, the Egyptian magicians were unable to replicate this plague.
Right.
It also appears to be a turning point.
Okay.
Where Pharaoh begins to show some willingness to compromise.
Okay.
Although his heart hardened again soon after.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
And then the devastating plague.
Yeah.
On the livestock.
Right.
A major economic and symbolic blow.
Yeah.
Which gods were in the firing line with that one.
This plague directly challenged numerous animal deities.
Right.
Particularly Neves.
Okay.
The bull god, who is seen as the earthly embodiment of Ra, the sun god.
Right.
Other important animal deities.
Okay.
Like Apis and Hathor were also affected. Right.
And so, you know, the economic devastation, as Dr. Rada highlights, quoting Dr. John Davis, would have been immense.
Right.
Crippling agriculture, transportation, even their religious practices as animals played a crucial role in worship and sacrifice.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Which leads us to that persistent question that Dr. Rada addresses.
Right.
Who was responsible for hardening Pharaoh's heart?
Right.
Right. Was it his own doing?
Right.
Or was it an act of God?
Yeah. So Dr. Roddy explains that the biblical text actually speaks of both.
Okay.
So initially, Pharaoh himself hardened his heart.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Revealing his deeply entrenched resistance and arrogance.
Right.
He actively chose to defy Yahweh.
Right.
Subsequently, the Bible also states that God hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Okay.
And so the key theological principle here is Yahweh's ultimate sovereignty.
Right.
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 He is the one who orchestrates events to fulfill his redemptive purposes, the liberation of his people for service and worship, even working through the existing stubbornness of someone like Pharaoh.
Right.
So it wasn't God transforming an innocent person into evil, but rather using Pharaoh's already defiant heart to further his plan of redemption and to showcase his power.
Right. That's a crucial distinction to understand.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've explored the initial understanding of redemption tied to land and people.
Right.
And then the powerful display of God's redemptive might in the Exodus.
Yeah.
How did this concept of redeeming people manifest itself beyond that initial context of servitude that we discussed?
Right. So Leviticus 25 laid out this system for the redemption of indentured servants.
Right.
Emphasizing community support.
Right.
Without the exploitation of interest or profit.
Right.
Another significant aspect was the redemption of the firstborn son.
Okay.
And so in Israelite tradition, the firstborn was considered holy to the Lord.
Yeah.
And was technically designated for service at the tabernacle or temple.
Right.
However, families had the option to redeem their firstborn son with 5 shekels, allowing him to remain within the family.
Okay.
And the story of Hannah dedicating her son Samuel to the Lord rather than redeeming him
provides a powerful example of the alternative complete devotion to God's service.
Right. So that really highlights the agency within the system and the different ways individuals could interact with these redemptive practices.
Right.
And then we have the compelling example of redeeming a widow, which brings us back to the role of the kinsman redeemer.
Right. So the law in Deuteronomy outlines that if if a man died
yeah.
without leaving an heir,
okay.
His brother had the responsibility
okay.
to redeem the widow, uh-huh. ensuring the continuation of
right.
the family line
right.
and inheritance.